When Ursula Burns was named CEO of Xerox, she became the first black woman to head a Fortune 500 company. That was in 2009. It was a critical time. The country was in the middle of the Great Recession. Burns wrote about this and more in her memoir, Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. She spoke with Here and Now's Tanya Mosley when the book came out last year.
And I want to ask you first about the title, Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. It was something your mother used to tell you. What does that phrase mean to you?
Right. Essentially, we were the typical come-from-nothing family. My mother was a first-generation immigrant, single parent. She was a welfare recipient. And when we were growing up, she would say to me always, this place that we live in that is run down and dirty, this neighborhood that we live in that's disordered and not cared for, is not who you are. Who you are the people you surround yourself with. Who you are is the values that you have. So don't look at this place and think that that's who you are. And she said, remember that when you're rich and famous. Just imagine how, like, spiritually connected she was to my life as I went on without even knowing it.
Your mom never made more than $4,400 a year. This is the reality for millions of Americans, even to this day. And I bring this up because we often talk about overcoming poverty, but never really the lessons and the grit that comes with that kind of life experience, the tricks at life that people without means employ to survive. So in many ways, what you learned growing up could be seen as an advantage in your corporate career. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I so love that you picked that up, because I was taught in college all of the things that college teaches you, just like every other white guy, or doesn't matter what ethnicity that was in the room with me, or female, etc. The thing that I brought to that room that they didn't have that I had was this thing that's called grit, this confidence in myself that I could be better if I put energy forward and if other people supported me. This sense that you get when you're different and you have little is something that America, actually, if you think about it, stands for. The whole story is you come here with nothing and you build up. So I think it was really important to how I made it through Xerox and up through Xerox and all of my experiences, even my work and boards, everything. I approach it from, you know, from where I was.
Can we talk a little bit about exceptionalism for a moment? You studied mechanical engineering, and you write that in college you were often treated as extraordinary because you were a black woman who excelled in science. Were you ever bothered by being looked at or treated as a unicorn?
Absolutely. People were saying to me things, even as I became CEO, even to this day, you are amazing. You are extraordinary. You are. And I realized that they were saying that more for themselves than for me. And here's my thesis. In order for me to sit in the room with them, which I did regularly, in many different rooms, right? Sit in the room with the President of the United States, sit in the room with them in business meetings, right? In negotiations, in whatever. That in order for them to feel comfortable with me being there, and every other person who looks like me not being there, they had to label me something other than just a regular old black woman. And I started to realize that this was more to justify the small numbers. You know, that may be a very negative approach to the compliment, but I don't feel it as the compliment. I don't see myself as being exceptional in any way, Tanya, in any way.
Well, with that, though, how do you reconcile that? Because at one time, in 2014, Forbes, I think, called you one of the most powerful women in the mm-hmm. world. So after climbing for 30 years and you're at this top spot and folks have been telling you you're great, you're wonderful all of this time, and they're right because you have more than 30 years experience. How do you reconcile then as the one who has the power, who's calling the shots, to then in part maybe a change in culture?
What will break down this barrier more and more is more and more, more and more people who look less and less like them. And by the way, them I love. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love white men. I love white women. I mean, this is not this thing like I want to keep you over. It's just that this is such an exclusive club of wealth and power and influence. It's a very, very exclusive club, and that club has to be integrated aggressively. We have to actually improve education throughout the nation, including in the neighborhoods that are not really rich. We have to improve healthcare. We have to improve opportunity to people who enter companies. We have to improve funding of startups. You name it. We have to equalize this more so that we can actually start to see, quote unquote, more exceptional people like Ursula Burns, end quote. Because I think if you do that, you will find that there are so many more people. You say, oh my God, this is not that exceptional. There are, you know, she's, don't get me wrong, she's good. She works hard. She can carry on a sentence. She can do integral math. She can lead a company. But there are a lot more people than just her that can do that.
Let's talk about your role at Xerox. 2009 is when you took over this top spot. You had the task of bringing Xerox into the future. What were some of the more challenging aspects to that mission of bringing this behemoth of a company into its future self?
Part of the challenge was fundamentally that when you are a behemoth, change is really, really hard. We were unbelievably excellent direct salespeople. We were unbelievably excellent makers of substantial machines that could last years. You know, all of the things about Xerox that were amazing were under attack, not by necessarily competition, but by advancements in technology, period. And we had to figure out a way to feel very comfortable with throwing a lot of these things that we loved away.
That sounds hard.
It is very, very hard because we had one unbelievably difficult variable in our business to predict, and that was humans. Businesses are about people. They're about people inside the company, and they're about customers and businesses who are made up of people outside the company. And to get this all to align well and to change easily, it's not like a program. You have to get a large number of people to align around the vision that you lay out, and you have to get them to start marching at least in the same direction, and then hopefully in the same direction at the same pace. That's one reason why it was very difficult. The other one is that, you know, we're dealing in a time where there's nothing that's a secret anymore. And you can actually get a following in social media or whatever the heck it is. And it basically exposes another flank for you that you have to kind of respond to as well.
You know, through this pandemic, the challenges of parenthood and working has been laid bare. Leaders can see really under the hood, so to speak, of all of the extra work that parents, especially mothers, are doing at home and at work. And I was intrigued by the challenges you write about in your book that you experienced in managing your home life and your work life as the CEO of this Fortune 500 company. With that power, what insights did you learn on how we can support parents with demanding work?
We have to make sure that we have support infrastructure for them in business. Government and business has to help. So healthcare has to be reasonable and affordable, even if you have three children. It can't be access to childcare. We have to figure out a way to have a better partnership between businesses and childcare provision and governments to actually assure that parenting is not this like horrible thing that we have to just kind of figure our way around. And then clearly career progression, pay, all of the basic infrastructures of work cannot suffer because one gender has to actually physically carry the child and therefore in the younger part of their life are more naturally aligned to take care of the child. This can't be a negative. It actually has to be at worst neutral, at best a positive.
Ursula, you said at the start of your book that you didn't feel like your life was interesting enough to fill the pages. I'm sorry, I have to chuckle at that. And yet you did. You filled all of the pages. What did you learn about yourself in the process of writing this book? And maybe what do you want people to take away from your book?
What I learned and what I want people to learn in this book is it doesn't take silver spoons always. It doesn't take tons of money. If we do little bits ourselves, we can actually transform not only our neighborhoods, but with that, we can transform our cities and then our states and then this country and then the world. I always push against this zero-sum game theory that we are playing right now, that I can only make it if I take it from you. It's so untrue. My life is proof that that's not the case. I have a lot, and I am willing to have people have joy and comfort, because it's fun. It's worth it. The city is fun. The world is fun. If we just can lift up people a little bit every day, it's not that hard. I mean, it is hard, obviously, Tanya, but it's not, you know, this is not impossible to do.
At the same time, it's simple.
Yes, at the same time, it's simple.
Ursula Burns's memoir is Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. Ursula, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.